Chapter 2 The phocomelus Hoppy Harrington generally wheeled up to Modern TV Sales and Service about 11 each morning. He generally glided into the shop, stopping his cart by the counter, and if Jim Ferguson was around, he asked to be allowed to go downstairs to watch the two TV repairmen at work. However, if Ferguson was not around, Hoppy gave up and after a while wheeled off because he knew that the salesman would not let him go downstairs. They merely ribbed him, gave him the runaround. He did not mind. Or at least as far as Stuart McConchie could tell, he did not mind. But actually, Stuart realized, he did not understand Hoppy, who had a sharp face with bright eyes and a quick, nervous manner of speech, which often became jumbled into a stammer. He did not understand him psychologically. Why did Hoppy want to repair TV sets? What was so great about that? The way the folkie hung around, one would think it was the most exalted calling of all. Actually, repair work was hard, dirty, and did not pay too well. But Hoppy was passionately determined to become a TV repairman, and now he had succeeded, because Ferguson was determined to do right by all the minority groups in the world. Ferguson was a member of the American Civil Liberties Union and the NAACP, and the Help for the Handicapped League, the latter being, as far as Stuart could tell, nothing but a lobby group on an international scale, set up to promote soft births for all the victims of modern medicine and science, such as the multitude from the Blutgeld catastrophe of 1972. "And what does that make me?" Stuart asked himself as he sat upstairs in the store's office, going over his sales book. "I mean," he thought, "with a folkie working here, that practically makes me a radiation freak too, as it being colored was a sort of early form of radiation burn." He felt gloomy thinking about it. Once upon a time, he thought, all the people on Earth were white, and then some horse's ass set off a high-altitude bomb back, say, around 10,000 years ago, and some of us got seared, and it was permanent. It affected our genes. So here we are today. Another salesman, Jack Lighthizer, came and sat down at the desk across from him and lit a Corona cigar. "I hear Jim's hired that kid on the cart," Lighthizer said. "You know why he did it, don't you? For publicity. The SF newspapers will write it up. Jim loves getting his name in the paper. It's a smart move when you get down to it. The first retail dealer in the East Bay to hire a folkie." Stuart grunted. "Jim's got an idealized image of himself," Lighthizer said. "He isn't just a merchant. He's a modern Roman. He's civic-minded. After all, he's an educated man. He's got a master's degree from Stanford." "That doesn't mean anything anymore," Stuart said. He himself had gotten a master's degree from Cal back in 1975, and look where it had got him. "It did when he got it," Lighthizer said. "After all, he graduated back in 1947. He was on that GI Bill they had." Below them, at the front door of Modern TV, a cart appeared, in the center of which, at a bank of controls, sat a slender figure. Stuart groaned, and Lighthizer glanced at him.
"He's a pest," Stuart said.
"He won't be when he gets started working," Lighthizer said. "The kid is all brain, no body at all, hardly. That's a powerful mind he's got, and he also has ambition. God, he's only 17 years old, and what he wants to do is work, get out of school and work. That's admirable." The two of them watched Hoppy on his cart. Hoppy was wheeling toward the stairs, which descended to the TV repair department.
"Do the guys downstairs know yet?" Stuart asked.
"Oh, sure, Jim told them last night. They're philosophical. You know how TV repairmen are. They griped about it, but it doesn't mean anything. They gripe all the time anyhow." Hearing the salesman's voice, Hoppy glanced sharply up. His thin, bleak face confronted them. His eyes blazed, and he said stammeringly,
"Hey, is Mr. Ferguson in right now?"
"Nah," Stuart said.
"Mr. Ferguson hired me," the folkie said.
"Yeah," Stuart said.
Neither he nor Lighthizer moved. They remained seated at the desk, gazing down at the folkie.
"Can I go downstairs?"
Hoppy asked. Lighthizer shrugged.
"I'm going out for a cup of coffee," Stuart said, rising to his feet. "I'll be back in 10 minutes. Wash the floor for me, okay?"
"Sure," Lighthizer said, nodding as he smoked a cigar. When Stuart reached the main floor, he found the folkie still there. He had not begun the difficult descent down to the basement.
Spirit of 1972, Stewart said as he passed the cart.
The fokey flushed and stammered, I was born in 1964. It had nothing to do with that blast.
As Stewart went out the door onto the sidewalk, the fokey called after him anxiously.
It was that drug, that thalidomide. Everybody knows that.
Stewart said nothing. He continued on toward the coffee shop. It was difficult for the Focomalus to maneuver his cart down the stairs to the basement where the TV repairmen worked at their benches, but after a time he managed to do so, gripping the handrail with the manual extensors which the U.S. government had thoughtfully provided. The extensors were really not much good. They had been fitted years ago, and were not only partly worn out, but were, as he knew from reading the current literature on the topic, obsolete. In theory, the government was bound to replace his equipment with the more recent models. The Remington Act specified that, and he had written the senior California senator, Alf M. Partland, about it. As yet, however, he had received no answer. But he was patient. Many times he had written letters to U.S. congressmen on a variety of topics, and often the answers were tardy or merely mimeographed, and sometimes there was no answer at all. In this case, however, Hoppy Harrington had the law on his side, and it was only a matter of time before he compelled someone in authority to give him that which he was entitled to. He felt grim about it, patient and grim. They had to help him, whether they wanted to or not. His father, a sheep rancher in the Sonoma Valley, had taught him that, taught him always to demand what he was entitled to. Sound blared, the repairman at work. Hoppy paused, opened the door, and faced the two men at the long littered bench with its instruments and meters, its dials and tools and television sets in all stages of decomposition. Neither repairman noticed him.
Listen, one of the repairmen said all at once, startling him. Manual jobs are looked down on. Why don't you go into something mental? Why don't you go back to school and get a degree?
The repairman turned to stare at him questioningly. No, Hoppy thought. I want to work with my hands.
You could be a scientist, the other repairman said, not ceasing his work. He was tracing a circuit, studying his voltmeter.
Like Bluthgeld, Hoppy said.
The repairman laughed at that with sympathetic understanding.
Mr. Ferguson said you'd give me something to work on, Hoppy said. Some easy set to fix to start with, okay?
He waited, afraid that they were not going to respond, and then one of them pointed to a record changer.
What's the matter with it? Hoppy said, examining the repair tag. I know I can fix it.
Broken spring, one of the repairmen said. It won't shut off after the last record.
I see, Hoppy said.
He picked up the record changer with his two manual extensors and rolled to the far end of the bench, where there was a cleared space.
I'll work here.
The repairman did not protest, so he picked up pliers. This is easy, he thought to himself. I've practiced at home. He concentrated on the record changer, but also watching the two repairmen out of the corner of his eye. I've practiced many times. It nearly always works, and all the time it's better, more accurate, more predictable. A spring is a little object, he thought, as little as they come, so light it almost blows away. I see the break in you, he thought. Molecules of metal not touching like before. He concentrated on that spot, holding the pliers so that the repairman nearest him could not see. He pretended to tug at the spring, as if trying to remove it. As he finished the job, he realized that someone was standing behind him, had come up to watch. He turned, and it was Jim Ferguson, his employer, saying nothing but just standing there with a peculiar expression on his face, his hands stuck in his pockets.
All done, Hoppy said nervously.
Ferguson said, Let's see. He took hold of the changer, lifted it up into the overhead fluorescent light's glare. Did he see me? Hoppy wondered. Did he understand? And if so, what does he think? Does he mind? Does he really care? Is he horrified? There was silence as Ferguson inspected the changer.
Where'd you get the new spring? He asked suddenly. I found it lying around, Hoppy said at once.
It was okay. Ferguson, if he had seen, had not understood. The Focomalus relaxed and felt glee, felt a superior pleasure take the place of his anxiety.
He grinned at the two repairmen, looked about for the next job expected of him. Ferguson said, "Does it make you nervous to have people watch you?"
"No,"
Hoppy said. "People can stare at me all they want. I know I'm different. I've been stared at since I was born."
"I mean when you work."
"No," he said, and his voice sounded loud, perhaps too loud, in his ears. "Before I had a cart," he said, "before the government provided me anything, my dad used to carry me around on his back in a sort of knapsack. Like a papoose." He laughed uncertainly.
"I see," Ferguson said.
"That was up around Sonoma," Hoppy said, "where I grew up. We had sheep. One time a ram butted me and I flew through the air like a ball."
Again he laughed. The two repairmen regarded him silently, both of them pausing in their work.
"I'll bet," one of them said after a moment, "that you rolled when you hit the ground."
"Yes," Hoppy said, laughing. They all laughed now, himself and Ferguson and the two repairmen. They imagined how it looked. Hoppy Harrington, 7 years old, with no arms or legs, only a torso and head, rolling over the ground, howling with fright and pain. But it was funny. He knew it. He told it so it would be funny. He made it become that way.
"You're a lot better set up now with your cart," Ferguson said.
"Oh, yes," he said. "And I'm designing a new one, my own design. All electronic. I read an article on brain wiring. They're using it in Switzerland and Germany. You're wired directly to the motor centers of the brain, so there's no lag. You move even quicker than a regular physiological structure."
He started to say, "than a human."
"I'll have it perfected in a couple of years," he said. "And it'll be an improvement even on the Swiss models. And then I can throw away this government junk."
Ferguson said in a solemn, formal voice, "I admire your spirit."
Laughing, Hoppy said with a stammer, "Thanks, Mr. Ferguson."
One of the repairmen handed him a multiplex FM tuner.
"It drifts. See what you can do for the alignment."
"Okay,"
Hoppy said, taking it in his metal extensors.
"I sure will. I've done a lot of aligning at home. I'm experienced with that."
He had found such work easiest of all. He barely had to concentrate on the set. It was as if the task were made to order for him and his abilities. Reading the calendar on her kitchen wall, Bonnie Keller saw that this was the day her friend, Bruno Bluthgeld, saw her psychiatrist, Dr. Stockstill, at his office in Berkeley. In fact, he had already seen Stockstill, had had his first hour of therapy, and had left. Now he no doubt was driving back to Livermore and his own office at the radiation lab, the lab at which she had worked years ago, before she had gotten pregnant. She had met Dr. Bluthgeld there back in 1975. Now she was 31 years old and living in West Marin. Her husband George was now vice principal of the local grammar school, and she was very happy. Well, not very happy. Just moderately, tolerably happy. She still took analysis herself, once a week now instead of three times, and in many respects she understood herself, her unconscious drives and paratactic systematic distortions of the reality situation. Analysis, 6 years of it, had done a great deal for her, but she was not cured. There was really no such thing as being cured. The illness was life itself, and a constant growth, or rather a viable growing adaptation, had to continue, or psychic stagnation would result. She was determined not to become stagnant. Right now she was in the process of reading The Decline of the West in the original German. She had gotten 50 pages read, and it was well worth it. And who else that she knew had read it, even in the English? Her interest in German culture, in its literary and philosophical works, had begun years ago through her contact with Dr. Bluthgeld. Although she had taken 3 years of German in college, she had not seen it as a vital part of her adult life. Like so much that she had carefully learned, it had fallen into the unconscious once she had graduated and gotten a job. Bluthgeld's magnetic presence had reactivated and enlarged many of her academic interests, her love of music and art. She owed a great deal to Bluthgeld, and she was grateful. Now, of course, Bluthgeld was sick, as almost everyone at Livermore knew. The man had profound conscience, and he had never ceased to suffer since the error of 1972, which, as they all knew,
all those who had been a part of Livermore in those days, was not specifically his fault. It was not his personal burden, but he had chosen to make it so, and because of that he had become ill, and more ill with each passing year. Many trained people, and the finest apparatus, the foremost computers of the day, had been involved in the faulty calculation. Not faulty in terms of the body of knowledge available in 1972, but faulty in relationship to the reality situation. The enormous masses of radioactive clouds had not drifted off, but had been attracted by the Earth's gravitational field, and had returned to the atmosphere. No one had been more surprised than the staff at Livermore. Now, of course, the Jameson French layer was more completely understood. Even the popular magazines such as Time and U.S. News could lucidly explain what had gone wrong and why. But this was 9 years later. Thinking of the Jameson French layer, Bonnie remembered the event of the day, which she was missing. She went at once to the TV set in the living room and switched it on. "Has it been fired off yet?" she wondered, examining her watch. No, not for another half hour. The screen lighted, and sure enough, there was the rocket and its tower, the personnel, trucks, gear. It was decidedly still on the ground, and probably Walter Dangerfield and Mrs. Dangerfield had not even boarded it yet. "The first couple to emigrate to Mars," she said to herself archly, wondering how Lydia Dangerfield felt at this moment. The tall, blonde woman, knowing that their chances of getting to Mars were computed at only about 60%. Great equipment, vast diggings and constructions awaited them. But so what if they were incinerated along the way? Anyhow, it would impress the Soviet bloc, which had failed to establish its colony on Luna. The Russians had cheerfully suffocated or starved. No one knew exactly for sure. In any case, the colony was gone. It had passed out of history as it had come in, mysteriously. The idea of NASA sending just a couple, one man and his wife, instead of a group, appalled her. She felt instinctively that they were courting failure by not randomizing their bets. It should be a few people leaving New York, a few leaving California, she thought as she watched on the TV screen the technicians giving the rocket last-minute inspections. What do they call that? Hedging your bets? Anyhow, not all the eggs should be in this one basket. And yet this was how NASA had always done it. One astronaut at a time from the beginning, and plenty of publicity. When Henry Chancellor, back in 1967, had burned to particles in his space platform, the entire world had watched on TV. Grief-stricken, to be sure, but nonetheless they had been permitted to watch. And the public reaction had set back space exploration in the West 5 years. "As you can see now," the NBC announcer said in a soft but urgent voice, "final preparations are being made. The arrival of Mr. and Mrs. Dangerfield is expected momentarily. Let us review, just for the sake of the record, the enormous preparations made to ensure—" "Blah," Bonnie Keller said to herself, and with a shudder shut off the TV. "I can't watch," she said to herself. On the other hand, what was there to do? Merely sit biting her nails for the next 6 hours? For the next 2 weeks, in fact? The only answer would have been not to remember that this was the day the first couple was being fired off. However, it was too late now not to remember. She liked to think of them as that, the first couple, like something out of a sentimental old-time science fiction story. Adam and Eve, once over again, except that in actuality Walt Dangerfield was no Adam. He had more the quality of the last, not the first man, with his wry, mordant wit, his halting, almost cynical manner of speech as he faced the reporters. Bonnie admired him. Dangerfield was no punk, no crew-cut-haired young blonde automaton hacking away at the Air Force's newest task. Walt was a real person, and no doubt that was why NASA had selected him. His genes, they were probably stuffed to overflowing with 4,000 years of culture, the heritage of mankind built right in. Walt and Lydia would found a Nova Terra. There would be lots of sophisticated little Dangerfields strolling about Mars, declaiming intellectually, and yet with that amusing trace of sheer jazziness that Dangerfield had. "Think of it as a long freeway," Dangerfield had once said in an interview, answering a reporter's query about the hazards of the trip. "A million miles of 10 lanes, with no oncoming traffic, no slow trucks. Think of it as being 4 o'clock in the morning. Just your vehicle, no others. So, like the guys say, what's to worry?" And then his good smile. Bending, Bonnie turned the TV set back on. And there, on the screen, was the round, bespeckled face of Walt Dangerfield. He wore his spacesuit, all but the helmet, and beside him stood Lydia, silent, as Walt answered questions.
"Ah, here,"
Walt was drawling, with a chewing movement of his jaw, as if he were masticating the question before answering.
"But there's a LOL in Boise, Idaho, who's worried about me."
He glanced up, as someone in the rear of the room asked something.
"A LOL?" Walt said. "Well, that was the great now-departed Herb Kane's term for little old ladies. There's always one of 'em everywhere. Probably there's one on Mars already, and we'll be living down the street from her. Anyhow, this one in Boise, or so I understand, is a little nervous about Lydia and myself. Afraid something might happen to us. So she sent us a good luck charm."
He displayed it, holding it clumsily with the big gloved fingers of his suit. The reporters all murmured with amusement.
"Nice, isn't it?" Dangerfield said. "I'll tell you what it does. It's good for rheumatism."
The reporters laughed.
"In case we get rheumatism while we're on Mars. Or is it gout? I think it's gout," she said in her letter.
He glanced at his wife.
"Gout, was it?"
I guess, Bonnie thought, they don't make charms to ward off meteors or radiation. She felt sad, as if a premonition had come over her. Or was it just because this was Bruno Bluthgeld's day at the psychiatrist's? Sorrowful thoughts emanating from that fact, thoughts about death and radiation and miscalculation and terrible, unending illness. "I don't believe Bruno has become a paranoid schizophrenic," she said to herself. "This is only a situation deterioration, and with the proper psychiatric help, a few pills here and there, he'll be okay. It's an endocrine disturbance manifesting itself physically, and they can do wonders with that. It's not a character defect, a psychotic constitution, unfolding itself in the face of stress." "But what do I know?" she thought gloomily. "Bruno had to practically sit there and tell us they were poisoning his drinking water before either George or I grasped how ill he was. He merely seemed depressed." Right this moment she could imagine Bruno with a prescription for some pill which stimulated the cortex or suppressed the diencephalon. In any case, the modern Western equivalent for contemporary Chinese herbal medicine would be in action, altering the metabolism of Bruno's brain, clearing away the delusions like so many cobwebs. And all would be well again. She and George and Bruno would be together again, with their West Marin Baroque recorder consort, playing Bach and Handel in the evenings. It would be like old times. Two wooden black forest, genuine recorders, and then herself at the piano. The house full of Baroque music and the smell of home-baked bread, and a bottle of Buena Vista wine from the oldest winery in California. On the television screen, Walt Dangerfield was wisecracking in his adult way, a sort of Voltaire and Will Rogers combined.
"Oh, yeah," he was saying to a lady reporter who wore a funny large hat. "We expect to uncover a lot of strange life forms on Mars."
And he eyed her hat as if saying,
"There's one now, I think."
And again the reporters all laughed.
"I think it moved,"
Dangerfield said, indicating the hat to his quiet, cool-eyed wife.
"It's coming for us, honey."
He really loves her, Bonnie realized, watching the two of them. I wonder if George ever felt toward me the way Walt Dangerfield feels toward his wife. I doubt it, frankly. If he did, he never would have allowed me to have those two therapeutic abortions. She felt even more sad now, and she got up and walked away from the TV set, her back to it. They ought to send George to Mars, she thought with bitterness. Or better yet, send us all, George and me in the Dangerfields. George can have an affair with Lydia Dangerfield, if he's able, and I can bed down with Walt. I'd be a fair to adequate partner in the great adventure. Why not?
I wish something would happen, she said to herself. I wish Bruno would call and say Dr. Stockstill had cured him, or I wish Dangerfield would suddenly back out of going, or the Chinese would start World War III, or George would really hand the school board back that awful contract as he's been saying he's going to. Something, anyhow.
Maybe, she thought, I ought to get out my potter's wheel and pot. Back to so-called creativity, or anal play, or whatever it is. I could make a lewd pot, design it, fire it in Violet Klatt's kiln, sell it down in San Anselmo at Creative Artworks, Inc., That society lady's place that rejected my welded jewelry last year. I know they'd accept a lewd pot, if it was a good lewd pot. At Modern TV, a small crowd had collected in the front of the store to watch the large stereo-color TV set, the Dangerfield's flight being shown to all Americans everywhere, in their homes and at their places of work. Stuart McConchie stood with his arms folded, back of the crowd, also watching.
"The ghost of John L. Lewis,"
Walt Dangerfield was saying in his dry way,
"would appreciate the true meaning of portal-to-portal pay. If it hadn't been for him, they'd probably be paying me about $5 to make this trip, on the grounds that my job doesn't actually begin until I get there."
He had a sobered expression now. It was almost time for him and Lydia to enter the cubicle of the ship.
"Just remember this. If something happens to us, if we get lost, don't come out looking for us. Stay home, and I'm sure Lydia and I will turn up somewhere."
"Good luck," the reporters were murmuring, as officials and technicians of NASA appeared and began bundling the Dangerfields off, out of view of the TV cameras.
"Won't be long,"
Stuart said to Lighthizer, who now stood beside him, also watching.
"He's a sap to go," Lighthizer said, chewing on a toothpick. "He'll never come back. They make no bones about that." "Why should he want to come back?" Stuart said. "What's so great about it here?"
He felt envious of Walt Dangerfield. He wished it was he, Stuart McConchie, up there before the TV cameras, in the eyes of the entire world. Up the stairs from the basement came Hoppy Harrington on his cart, wheeling eagerly forward.
"Have they shot him off?"
he asked Stuart in a nervous, quick voice, peering at the screen.
"He'll be burned up. It'll be like that time in 65. I don't remember it, naturally, but—"
"Shut up, will you?"
Lighthizer said softly, and the Phacomalus, flushing, became silent. They all watched then, each with his own private thoughts and reactions, as on the TV screen the last inspection team was lifted by an overhead boom from the nose cone of the rocket. The countdown would soon begin. The rocket was fueled, checked over, and now the two people were entering it. The small group around the TV set stirred and murmured. Sometime later today, sometime in the afternoon, their waiting would be rewarded, because Dutchman 4 would take off. It would orbit the Earth for an hour or so, and the people would stand at the TV screen watching that, seeing the rocket go around and around, and then finally the decision would be made, and someone below in the blockhouse would fire off the final stage, and the orbiting rocket would change trajectory and leave the world. They had seen it before. It was much like this, every time, but this was new, because the people in this one, this time, would never be returning. It was well worth spending a day in front of the set. The crowd of people was ready for the wait. Stuart McConchie thought about lunch, and then after that he would come back here and watch again. He would station himself here once more, with the others. He would get little or no work done today, would sell no TV sets to anybody, but this was more important. He could not miss this. "That might be me up there some day," he said to himself. "Maybe I'll emigrate later on when I'm earning enough to get married, take my wife and kids and start a new life up there on Mars, when they get a really good colony going, not just machines." He thought of himself in the nose cone, like Walt Dangerfield, strapped next to a woman of great physical attractiveness. Pioneers, he and her, founding a new civilization on a new planet. But then his stomach rumbled, and he realized how hungry he was. He could not postpone lunch much longer. Even as he stood watching the great upright rocket on the TV screen, his thoughts turned toward soup and rolls and beef stew and apple pie with ice cream on it, up at Fred's Fine Foods.